This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, paging Dr. Love. What the romance genre can tell us about writing.
I love that you couldn't hold back the little giggle there.
I know. I was trying not to say paging Dr. Love.
Give into it. Give into it. Today is an episode about romance, no?
Yes. Basically, this is an episode about the romance genre as a whole. So, I know this is incredibly unlikely, particularly coming from me. But there's actually a lot that romance as a genre can teach us about writing. And before we get started, let's establish what we mean by romance. So,
yes.
Obviously, you have romance with a capital R versus romance with a small r, lowercase r. And basically, if you see anything described as a romance with a capital R or a high romance, what they're talking about is following on from the medieval tradition of a very set piece of literature with various tropes and things. It actually doesn't really have very much to do with love stories.
No.
It's like the idea of the Arthurian cycle is sometimes described as a high romance because basically what they're looking at is the precursor to epic fantasy, I think, with a lot of these high romance concepts.
Yeah. Because I think the idea of something being romantic, you know, when you use the word romantic now, we tend to think of it in terms of it very exclusively being love between two people in a you know, I want to be your partner, I want to kiss you or hold your hand kind of way. But before that, and actually not even that long ago, for something to be romantic, to have a sort of sweeping romance, was for it to almost be kind of a bit fantastical, for it to have this whimsical quality to it.
Yes, and it included quite a lot of adventure as well. You'd describe a sweeping romantic landscape, and the idea was the landscape was somewhere where adventure could happen, something a bit fantastical. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at romance, little r, today. on that note, we're also sort of romance versus love stories. Now, this is very genre specific with little r romance. A romance in terms of a book is basically that book will have a happy ending. It will have a happily ever after. The main point with a romance novel is that you will get to the end of it and the couple will have got together.
Yeah.
If it has an unhappy ending, then it doesn't qualify as a romance. It's technically a love story.
Yeah. So Romeo and Juliet is not a romance. It is it's a love story, but it's a tragedy. And of course, sorry, we also should mention that in sort of the Shakespearean terms, romance and tragedy, it was defined by do they get married at the end or do they die?
Yeah, he really didn't have a lot of leeway for anything else, did he?
No. Well, we'll just cordially go our separate ways. It was, look, you either marry or you die.
You get to pick one of these two disastrous end states. Obviously, so romance has meant lots of different things over the years. And as Madeleine said, it's actually very recent that romance has come to mean intimacy between two people, or maybe many people. I don't know. I haven't seen a romance novel where six people all get together in one polyamorous love fest at the end, but it's probably out there.
Do let us know if you've written it.
Romance as a genre is becoming a lot more expansive and inclusive. Originally, romance was very much a heterosexual province, I suppose, and a very cis-normative province as well. And, you know, it reflects the attitude of the time. This isn't necessarily because the genre itself was faulty. It was just a case of, you know, the authors who were writing it were probably not as well informed about other issues, or perhaps they just didn't necessarily see those things. Whereas now you have an awful lot of LGBTQ+ people going and writing romance. So it's not as hard to say, if you want to find a Regency romance with a sapphic pairing. That's actually not too difficult to find now, which is quite nice.
It is very nice. Nothing like a sapphic bodice ripper.
Nothing like a sapphic bodice ripper. Or that absolute, what was it even called? I don't remember. It was a Highlander something or other, but the Highlander was female and she was a very strapping alpha female with a time-travelling Victorian scientist who sort of ended up in the Highlands. And I don't know. Again, it was an absolute bodice ripper, but with two women. And it was incredibly entertaining. I can't remember the name of it now. That's dreadful.
Are you sure this isn't just a dream?
No, I'm pretty damn sure I've got sent a copy of that book. I will find out. Anyway, so while romance might not be your favourite genre, and it's absolutely not mine, I'll be honest, it consistently delivers where its target audience is concerned. And it's a lot more complicated than people think it is. I think a lot of people hear, oh god, it's a romance, it's chick lit kind of thing. And it gets denigrated. Actually, romance is such a well-established genre, and it is the most popular genre. It's even more popular than crime. So we do slightly prefer love to murder as a species, which is good to know.
But have you considered love and love murder? And,
oh god, well, you know, see, there's a Venn diagram there where the two genres cross over. Romance actually has a lot of very intricate tropes and story milestones, and if you're reading one, if the author's done their work, you're not even aware that you're hitting those milestones unless you are reading it as a writer and you're aware of what those are. One thing I will guarantee is anyone who's writing a romance book who does not hit those milestones, or a certain number of them, that book will flop because you're not delivering what your audience wants. So you can learn a lot as a writer from looking at a few romance novels.
Yeah, definitely. And romance, I think the main problem with romance is actually that certain areas of romance or certain storylines have been done over and over and over. And people get quite tired of them. So namely the busy businesswoman doesn't know how to let go until she meets laid-back guy who annoys her into, taking off her glasses and having a wild time and maybe thinking about love instead of work. And at first the two dislike each other, but eventually they get to know each other and they fall in love. And you see that all the time when it comes to... they make a lot of sort of chick flick movies about that. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that story, but I think that what happens is that when people think romance, they think of that because it comes up a lot. And romance is actually a lot more diverse now, not just in terms of the sort of the characters in it, but the way that the genre is explored is actually a lot more diverse. And just because you have that kind of storyline doesn't necessarily mean that the story itself lacks sophistication, because, as Jules said, if you don't get something quite right in romance, it flops immediately. It's not that there's a rigid sort of set of rules, but it's so well established and it's actually so carefully and well structured that if you don't hit all the points at the right time, the whole thing becomes very jarring.
Definitely. And the other thing you're obviously doing is you're hitting those beats in a way that your readers are experiencing as new, even though most romance readers are voracious and will get through 4 or 5 books in a week, and they will get through hundreds of books in a year if you just add 4 books a week up. And it's just a case of, every time you deliver a romance book, if you really want to make an impression, they have to not be aware that they are reading something that they kind of have already read before. Because what they want is what they've read before, but they want it delivered in a new way, which is where the originality of things come in. And obviously, because it is such a huge popular genre, in order to stand out, your unique selling point has to be pretty damn unique.
Absolutely.
So I suppose the thing is that romance as a genre walks the tightrope between having to be extremely marketable because it's providing everything that its readers want, and also fresh and original enough that people feel that they haven't read it before, even though they absolutely have.
Yeah. Which is actually quite hard.
It's a really difficult balancing act. I know a lot of writers who've gone on to write things like crime and mystery and historical fiction and reading group fiction as well. And all of them sort of have said at various points that they wanted to write and they wanted to get money for their writing, and there's nothing wrong with that. So what they thought they'd do is they'd write a Mills and Boone, because Mills and Boone pay, I'm not sure what the flat fee now is, but it used to be £20,000 for a single sort of 60 to 70,000 word novel.
Right.
Which sounds like a good trade. I mean, you're giving all the rights, but then the chances of your Mills and Boone book getting made into a film are like very, very slender. And if you ever apply to write for Mills and Boone, which admittedly I never have, but just because I genuinely think I would come across as so insincere, nobody would be interested anyway. I genuinely don't have the interest. But I would love there to be a fantasy version of Mills and Boone, actually, because I think I could do that. But basically, they give you a sort of sheet telling you where things have to go, and it's not like they're giving you an outline, they're just telling you what your story beats are and how you have to hit them. And obviously you have medical romance and you have historical romance and you have mystery romance and things like that. They've got their little subgenres,
yeah,
and they're catering for a very specific audience. And the reason they are so damn successful and have been for decades is because they are very good at drilling down and providing what that audience wants.
Yeah.
All of these authors, and I'm talking perhaps 7 or 8 of them, I think, who have now gone and become really well established with big 5 publishers, all of them, to a woman, said, yeah, we tried this, and Mills and Boone said no thank you very much. It's really, really hard to get in there. I know one person who did used to write for Mills and Boone, and then they changed their parameters and she got dropped. So, yeah. I sneer at Mills and Boone because it's not my sort of thing, but honestly, looking at them objectively, they write compelling stuff for their target audience. I just don't happen to be in the target audience, and it is very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is worth remembering that just because something isn't your particular cup of tea doesn't mean that the genre itself lacks sophistication, consideration, and is somehow easy. I think there is this idea that writing romance is easy because it's so well, it's such a well-loved genre, and people tend to use the same kind of structure, but that actually makes it harder.
Yeah.
It really does.
It does make it harder, for the reasons we've discussed. So let's look at why romance is so popular, or at least my theories as someone who admittedly reads very, very little straight up romance in any of its subgenres.
Yeah.
Why it's so popular.
Well, I think the first thing is that romance is popular because it is boundless. You can set it pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
And it can just be tailored to pretty much anything. So any time period, you know, you could have it in space, you could have it in Regency England. It's just open to pretty much anything, which gives it a little bit more of that wiggle room.
Yeah, historical romance, mythological romance, fantasy romance, contemporary romance, coffee shop romance. There's all the subgenre of romance now where somebody opens a bakery or, you know, a patisserie or something like that. You know, they're making sweet things, and, that's a hugely popular up and coming one. So yeah, you're right, you absolutely can set it anywhere. And I suppose the closest I really got in many ways is semi-fantasy, semi-mythological romance is the sort of Juliet Marillier type books, where, yes, there is a strong romantic component, and you could even argue it takes up at least half the plot. It's not really just a subplot, but the focus is very much on a female main character, and as part of her journey she genuinely ends up with somebody, and they've all so far got happy endings as well.
Yay!
Obviously the heroine often goes through hell in order to get there, so there's a very Hardy-esque component in that respect. And obviously you've got the Fae and you've got mythological things happening, you've got magic, but it's not really epic fantasy style at all. So it's an interesting blend of sort of Scottish and Irish mythology with a strong historical romance component. And apparently that blend I can get on board with, mostly.
I mean, again, it's like we've mentioned it before, but Outlander as well is a romance.
Yes, it is. I have to admit, I read Outlander because I really enjoyed the historical detail, because it's incredibly well researched. Mm. The actual characters getting together and stuff, I was not that fussed about, I've got to say.
And yet.
It's kind of like, after book one, it's like, just talk to me more about herbs and other stuff that they're doing at the time.
But what about, never mind Jamie, what about the herbs?
It's like, yeah, I mean, Jamie seems all right as a romantic lead. Anyway, we'll get on to romantic leads in a minute. That's a kind of bugbear of mine, I'm afraid. But, another thing it does, and this is something that I won't just say that women prefer this, but it is very noticeable that stories that are largely more aimed at a female crowd tend to focus on the internal journey of a character as much as external conflict.
Mm.
So that is something that's very true of romance. Yeah. The person who starts at the very beginning of the story is not the same person who emerges at the end of the story. Or if they are, that's not a romance, that's a love story, and generally something's gone very wrong.
Yeah.
And they haven't ended up with the person they were supposed to.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the other thing that makes me laugh when people sneer at romance. When you look at all the epics of old, they are in essence romances. And they usually are about the union between two people, or the betrayal of two people for someone else. You know, there's love plays a big part in all of the sort of the major mythologies and our epics and things like that, and all the old stories. And romance basically is also a genre which looks at the psychology of human beings, because there's nothing quite as complicated as two people who come together. Now, I don't necessarily mean that in just a romantic sense. If you actually think about it, being friends with someone is totally wild.
Absolutely.
You just happen to be two completely unrelated people who happen to sort of like the same things, and when I'm with you, you know, I get endorphins in my brain.
Yeah, you form a bond. It's really interesting that a lot of Victorian romances with a capital R feature friendship in that way, that really strong undying friendship, especially between men, but also between women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could very easily say that, you know, Sherlock and Watson, Holmes and Watson, that was a romantic pair. Those were romantic stories. Whether or not you actually believe that the pair were involved with one another, they were incredibly close to one another. So romances look at that sort of the psychology of being a person, and also how you change depending on the people that you meet. But it's not change necessarily a bad way, it's meant to be positive change. And that starts to get very complicated, actually, which is why a good romance hits hard, because it's actually looking at the human condition and one of the most important aspects of the human condition, which is our ability to socialise and come together.
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of life in microcosm, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that, you know, the whole internal character journey, how this relationship or how this encounter is changing this person is a really important one.
Yeah.
I think I talked about Julie Cohen's Spirited recently as a recommendation, and the whole thing is largely Viola's journey from being this sort of innocent young girl who's bereaved and has lost her father, finding out that there might actually be a little bit more and getting beyond grief and thinking, well, actually, there may well be a life beyond this one, which may bring comfort to people. And then realizing that actually she's what she's always been told and what she's always thought she wanted out of life was something completely different to what she really wanted. So again, you've got that someone who has genuinely grown throughout the story and through her encounters with other people.
Yeah. And ultimately it is about the ultimate romance is a coming of equals, of two people who meet one another and who provoke change or opportunity within one another.
Yeah.
And that's the very interesting thing, is that it goes both ways. In a successful romance, it won't just be one person who changes, it'll be both of them who changes. And not necessarily just because of the other one, but because of the new world that they've entered through association of this person.
Yeah, definitely. Other things that romance does, romance, as we've said, in contrast to a love story, consistently deliver a happy, or at least a bittersweet happy ending. So you might have someone who doesn't quite get everything they want, but generally they will end up with the person that you've been gradually foreshadowing and telegraphing to your reader that they should end up with at the end. And hopefully they will have changed significantly as people because of this.
Exactly.
So yes, we're on to, I suppose, the wish fulfillment and escapism aspect there. I love the way that we often describe romance as being a bit, you know, facile perhaps, and easy, and it's wish fulfillment. I mean, yes, it is wish fulfillment and escapism, but I've yet to read any romance. Now, again, I've not read as much as I have in other genres, but I've certainly read enough where the people who are clearly being, you know, that they're clearly meant to be paired up and they end up together at the end, where it's actually been easy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also point out that there's, you know, people say, oh, romance is just wish fulfillment. I mean, to be honest, most things are wish fulfillment, aren't they? You're not reading about dragons because you're interested in, you know, the biology. You're reading about, well, you might be, but you know,
I think it really wish depends. Fulfillment.
But yeah, as you say, it's I don't know a single version where actually it does come easy, as you say. In fact, it tends to be very, very difficult, and that tends to be the interesting thing. And I'd also like to point out that, so what if it is wish fulfillment?
Yeah, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that at all. You know, or escapism. We read and we watch films and things to take a step away from our own lives, and that helps us to make sense of things that are going on, so that when we go back, we're recharged and we're refocused. I mean, okay, potentially hot button topic, particularly since Midnight Sun's just come out, but the whole sort of, like, I don't think anybody genuinely reads Twilight because they like vampires so much as they like the idea of this paranormal romance, which is ultimately what it is. Those books are focused entirely on the romance. So I'll laugh a bit at people who say, well, nothing really happens. It's like, well, no, nothing happens in the way that you mean, because you think the entire love story, which is the point of those books, is nothing. So you're not getting out of it what you want, because genuinely what you want is not the love story. You just want vampires going around killing people, which is not what it's about.
Yeah, if you want that, there's plenty of other movies, but it's ultimately a love story.
It is entirely a love story. I mean, there's other stuff going on. You wouldn't get me on board with those with just a straightforward paranormal romance, because I would genuinely get bored, because I'm not the target audience for that. But because there's some quirky humour in there, and because they're looking at this impossible balance between a very, very unequal relationship, which is actually not entirely the main character's fault at all, and some truly appalling decision making, it's very compulsive reading. It's compulsive escapism. Yeah, really, really bad. But I think perhaps one of the reasons that I enjoy it so much as a piece of escapism is simply because I'm like, this is great. This is totally the opposite to how I would react. This is not me. This is me taking a break from being me. And you know what? When I go back, I appreciate being me that much more.
So savage.
I mean, they are fun. I get a little bit sort of frustrated with people who can't just say, well, you know, it's a piece of escapism. What the hell's wrong with wish fulfillment fantasy?
Yeah.
It seems a bit silly.
I have my quibbles about it, but yes, I tend to agree with you. But exactly as you say, that it's there's nothing wrong with wish fulfillment, particularly because, well, actually, we're doing it very often anyway. Now, without sort of going into the whole gender stereotypes thing or anything else, there does tend to be also more of a need when it comes to women wanting, you know, fantasizing about stable relationships rather than, or sex with meaning,
or
rather than the physical side of things.
Yeah, or a marriage or relationship whereby they are, you know, not just tolerated but actively cherished and appreciated and considered an equal partner. I mean, it's disturbing that should be a piece of escapism, but it's there.
Yeah. And something that always gets me is people who sneer at romance, and this is like all these silly women watching this romance and this improbable stuff, are also the kinds of people, you know, who will very gladly sort of watch porn and things like that. Nice. Just they're like,
yeah.
Well, same, you know, same kettle, different fish, maybe.
Yes, perhaps. So yeah, I mean, it does an awful lot of things in terms of wish fulfillment and escapism. And as a final point on the escapism, for those who would say that, you know, your idea of escapism is very narrow, if what you're escaping to is a stable relationship, yeah, rather than on dragon back in a war somewhere, then I would just like to say, well, maybe you're lucky and you don't have that lack in your life, or maybe you genuinely haven't noticed that you've got that lack, or maybe you're perfectly happy and you just can't conceive of the fact that perhaps someone else just needs to take a step away. The whole thing with the idea of a one true love, etc., is if you take the one true love concept from fairy tales, it's a terrifying destructive force that leaves lots of casualties in its wake. You don't actually want it to happen in real life, but it's fun to read about it.
Yeah, I think that's also the other thing, is that it's sort of in fiction, the idea of this is like, I found the one, my soulmate, the one and only for me. Or you know, true love and things like that, and I'm just there like, that's great. And I love it in fiction. It's just they're like, oh yes, and they were soulmates, wonderful. In real life, that idea is horrifying.
It really is. It's a terrible idea. But that's why, again, it's fun to read about. It's fun, you know. It's fun to watch a film about it. The ones where it kind of doesn't lose its shine for me and I don't start suddenly coming out in hives or what have you are the ones where it's not this earth-shattering thing, but where it's a case of, oh no, this was improbable and there've been all these obstacles and things, and they've kind of got to the end and acknowledged each other as equal but different, but they sort of fit together kind of thing, and there's a lot of laughter involved as well. That's okay, I can get on board with that. The whole, it's like you were talking about Rothering Heights on Twitter the other day, Madeline. And I'm like, okay, for a start, that was an anti-romance. That was the entire point of the book. I know you weren't calling it a romance. But a lot of people still do. And it's like, A, nobody... Okay, in fairness, young Catherine does end up with Hindley. Not sure whether we're going to call that a love story. It's definitely still a hate story, in my opinion. Yeah. But generally, everybody dies. Everybody dies.
In fact, I would say not enough people die.
It's a romance with a capital R in terms of improbable and whimsy and adventure and some genuine horror.
Yeah.
it's not a romance with a lowercase r in the sense of, oh, it has a happily ever after, and, you know, even at its worst point, its point of ritual death, which is a romance term, believe it or not, it's when it hits the point of ritual death, it's going down further from there. It's more like Lovecraft in that respect.
It just keeps getting worse.
So, I mean, I love it when people say, oh, yeah, the Bronte's works are so romantic. And I'm like, honestly, the only genuine romance written by any of the Brontes is probably Jane Eyre. The rest of them are not romances at all.
No. But they all had a funny relationship with romance, so...
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got to think about it. They were kept relatively isolated, although not as isolated as Charlotte claimed. And yeah. They were sold this idea that you found somebody and your entire happiness depended upon them, which Emily clearly really rejected, and Anne rejected in her own way, but in less strong terms than Emily. And Charlotte kind of embraced with the fervour of someone who was, you know, on some level of her life, a genuine submissive. There's a lot of very interesting speculation. You'd have to read Juliet Barker's The Brontes, but it does make a lot of sense. So yeah, it's kind of like if you or I absolutely were sold on the idea of the one true love thing from fairy tales and we refused to accept anything else. And I think the thing is, I know we're getting sidetracked now, but people can get very locked into that mindset. And then what happens is that nobody's quite good enough, because the person who gets locked into that mindset then doesn't realise that actually part of finding the right person, if you're just looking for one person, is doing quite a lot of work on yourself.
Yeah.
And learning to appreciate yourself and be good company for yourself first.
Yeah. The idea of the perfect relationship from the get-go it doesn't really exist. Relationships do take work. That's not to say you can't be very in love very quickly and, you know, actually get on very quickly and things like that. You can. But relationships in general take work. There's not just this, and they saw each other and everything was fine. Like, they've got to have a conversation. You know, you've got to find out what he does with his dirty socks.
Thank you for that imagery. It's something that I think, believe it or not, Disney actually deconstructed very well in Enchanted.
Yes. Yeah. It was actually quite like the way they did that.
I enjoyed that as well. That, and that's a genuine sort of, until you know, you've got Giselle, your main character, who just believes that it's going to be, you know, her one true love, first sight, etc. And both of them are really locked into this mindset, and then they get divided and she has to question everything. And it's good that she does question everything.
Yeah.
Because she becomes a more rounded, full person. And there is a lot of wish fulfillment involved in that film. And it's very, very funny. It's really poking fun at the fairy tale. Yeah.
The thing I really like about that film is that one moment where you have this couple that want to get divorced. And she's like, oh no, that won't do. And I actually quite like it because they sort of actually stop fighting and they look at each other and they talk. And it's clear that they haven't actually talked properly for a long time.
Yeah, they've stopped seeing.
And actually, they both sort of go, actually, we both still love each other, and maybe we can still make this work. And I really liked that, because, again, it also brings up this idea that actually love can actually be difficult.
Yeah, there are times when you probably don't even like each other, you know?
Definitely.
That's perfectly normal. I think some people hit the thing where, oh, we're in love, we have to think each other are wonderful all the time. It's like, no, sometimes you're just not, okay?
Yeah, sometimes people argue. You know, I appreciate the fact that sometimes I'm a bit of a shit. And I can appreciate that, you know, even though I think my partner loves me very much, that doesn't mean that there aren't times when they get frustrated with me.
We've sort of actually discussed this next point without actually saying that we were discussing it, but basically the sort of conflict that you get in romance that we've been talking about is not too difficult to layer over your own life, and, you know, it sort of holds a mirror up for you to see things and question things, or, you know, a good romance should actually do that for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Final point in the why is romance so popular, there's always a new couple to meet and fall for and root for.
Yes. Now, this is actually where I think a lot of people start to fall out with romance, is that there has been this spat of stories where it's essentially the same couple over and over and over again. And that is boring. But actually, romance, as we've said before, opens up the doors for all sorts of possibility. And there is something there for everybody. There really is.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And, you know, sometimes it's a case of if you start to get bored with the way one thing is done, then it's time to change authors. It's not time to necessarily throw away an entire genre or subgenre. Okay, one of my guilty pleasures is Molly Harper's Half Moon Hollow series. Each book is different. Each book has got a different couple, and they are paranormal creatures. So Half Moon Hollow is sort of this place. Vampires are, and shapeshifters and witches and things are out in society, or most of them are. But it's not just an excuse for lots of smut like it is with Charlene Harris. This is no offence to Charlene Harris, because in fairness, those books are very entertaining as well. The Suki Stackhouse ones. But Half Moon Hollow, I think, has a lot more wit. And the main characters, you know, you've got a different main character for each book and different things to overcome. I mean, ultimately, they are essentially romances. But
yeah,
it was one of those things where I think Audible had one of its, you know, all these books for £3 each sales. And I picked up, what was it called? The Care and Feeding of Stray Vampires. And I'm like, for £3, that's worth a punt on audiobook. And it was really, really good. I mean, I won't make the mistake of listening to one aloud in the library again, because it got to a smutty bit and I wasn't expecting it. And it was very, very loud. That was kind of, you know, you're scrabbling to turn something off and you're just making it louder and louder and louder. It's like,
you just flip it onto the projectors.
That's me fanning myself with one hand because, oh shit, I think everyone outside can hear me turning it off at the same time. But no, it was really, really funny. It's this woman who basically works as a... She's sort of like a personal assistant, but she's hired out by lots of different people to do jobs for vampires during the day, because they can't go out in the daylight. And she's always sort of been in the position of, okay, you don't get involved with vampires, because even though they've all signed the treaty to say, you know, they're not going to feed on humans, etc., blah, 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 you can't trust them because some of them are a bit like that. So when she finds one literally dying on her doorstep, she's kind of like, well, shit, I suppose I have to take him in because he is a person and he can't remember who he is or where he's come from or what happened to him. Aww. And it's absolutely hilarious. And she's got a very snarky teenage sister that she's looking after as well. And it's just really, really funny. So there you go, guilty pleasure.
That sounds good.
So as we were saying, romance, there's something for everybody. There is some subgenre out there that will tick your boxes, even if you think you're not a romance reader.
Yeah, they really will. And sometimes it's okay to also actually want to, you know, watch or read the stories which are all the same. I'm not going to lie, around Christmas, when I'm usually sort of, you know, wrapping presents or organising things, I will sometimes just put on a Hallmark movie. And I know what the plot is.
I mean, let's be honest.
The characters are all the same. They always film in the same location.
I mean, last December, when Madeline and I buddy watched A Night Before Christmas, we knew where that plot was going. There were no surprises.
Absolutely no surprises.
Well, okay, I was a little bit surprised that she let him drive her car, but other than that...
Yeah, that was a bit surprising. Mostly we were just commenting on the fact that it was like about his treatment of the hag.
Yeah, so it was very funny. And yes, we were partly snarkily watching it, but I think that was kind of the sort of added to the overall enjoyment of the films.
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, I do watch it, and like every now and again, you know, I do actually like to watch the whole sort of, you know, A Princess for Christmas, and I'm like, yeah, it appeals to something inside of me, and I'm not ashamed of that. It's one of my little guilty pleasures, but you know, it's okay to enjoy those kinds of things too. It is complete wish fulfillment, and it's like comfort watching. You don't necessarily always have to be reading or watching stuff which has great sustenance.
Yes, yeah, doesn't always have to be challenging you. Sometimes it's okay to take a break, and I have to admit the Half Moon Hollow books, which don't require very much from me but are very funny and entertaining, and the Mystic Bio books as well, are kind of like, yeah, I'm just going to listen to these for a couple of weeks because, or read these for a couple of weeks just because I'm working on a tricky bit of writing and I don't want to have to think too much about what I'm reading.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
So, yes.
So there's that. Having nailed our colours to the wall on this one, what can writing teach us about romance? What can romance teach us about writing is what I was really going for. Believe it or not, the main thing is structure, and I realise that I am the structure bear, as I've been called by several writing friends. Structure bear. It was, you know, it's not a great superhero name, but I guess I'm just going to roll into it.
Structure bear is here.
Structure bear is here to sort your plot problems out. But yeah, romance is very intricately and stringently plotted and structured, and if a romance flops 10-1, there's going to be something wrong with the structure. So we've talked about the milestones. There's actually lots of little different milestones, but I'll talk about some of the main ones. So, I mean, if you want to learn about consistently delivering well-structured books that hit their target audience, then you could do a lot worse than look at romance. So obviously people will know about things like three-act structure or five-act structure. They will know about things like the inciting incident. But what they're not necessarily thinking about is things like first significant meeting. So the first significant meeting is where you, in romance terms, you get your... it's your meet-cute. So in films, it's where you have your heroine and your hero, sort of, they bump into each other. Perhaps she spills coffee all over him or something. And it's usually something it sets the tone for then the rest of their relationship. So it's a really, really important moment.
Yeah.
And you can...
for instance, Pride and Prejudice, the meet cute is the ball.
She's tolerable, I suppose, but not handsome enough to tempt me. And that sets the tone for the rest of the relationship. That's not Jane Austen just going, oh yeah, this is a Burke at a ball. This is Jane Austen saying, okay, this is where we're starting from. He's just been incredibly rude in her hearing, and now he's going to fall in love with her and have to find a way back from that. I mean, most of us, okay, if we were out at a pub or something and someone said, oh yeah, go and talk to so-and-so, you know, she's very pretty too, and if the person then turned around and went like, well, I suppose she's all right, but she's not really good enough for me, you wouldn't feel that inclined to give them the time of day afterwards.
No, you wouldn't.
And probably a lot of people would not be able to just laugh it off like Elizabeth Bennet does. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a great example of a meet-cute. If we weren't talking romance, meet-cutes are actually really important things in terms of friends meeting or people who are going to be, you know, amicable enemies or even bad enemies. So... if you look at The Holiday, which is about two different women ultimately finding the right people for them, but I would say the most important meet-cute for Kate Winslet's character, Iris, is when, and he actually calls it her meet-cute, is when she meets the nonagenarian Hollywood film director who's gone out of his house and got completely lost. And she's like, well, actually, I think I know where you are. I'll give you a lift home. And he says afterwards, oh, that was some meet-cute. And he ends up being a really significant influence for her sort of getting over this person who's treated her really badly and starting to value herself. So there's that one. There's, okay, in my perspective, this isn't romance at all, but there's a meet-cute at the very, very beginning of Revolt where Gregory really wakes up and there's someone, like, composing poetry over him. It's like, this turns into a three-book series, but Gregory's really genuinely thinking about boxing the guy's ears. Because obviously the last thing you want when you wake up and you've been drinking and then someone's beaten the shit out of you and robbed you is some prat standing over you pronouncing poetry.
About you.
Yes, about you as well.
Oh... it is a meet-cute, isn't it? That's wonderful. I'm so happy.
Back to romance, the meet cute is between the two main characters who are supposed to get together, and you're even giving the reader clues that these two are meant for each other at the beginning, and then you are, this is you setting up your stool, and then you are going to systematically deconstruct that stool until the reader, who knows it's a romance novel and knows that they're going to get together, is wondering how the hell it's going to happen, and then even doubting it's going to happen. So
yeah.
I mean, that's a milestone you have to hit. Other milestones you might hit, sort of the first date. Often it's disastrous.
Yes.
Maybe the first time they have sex. I suppose it really depends on the book.
Yeah.
And again, that's usually a sort of 60% mark. And it happens before what they call the point of ritual death. This is when everything looks like it's going down the toilet.
Yeah.
So someone doesn't have to die, but it has to be the death of something, either the death of someone's hopes and dreams, the death of perhaps another character that affects everything. So if you think of Four Weddings and a Funeral,
yeah.
The death of the, I can't remember the character's name, but the older man who was part of the gay couple who drops down dead at a wedding, and it's really traumatic. It's really, really, really sad. And I mean, you could argue that in Four Weddings and a Funeral, the great romance is between that group of friends more than necessarily the main character, between Hugh Grant and Andy McDowell.
Yeah.
But it's obviously them as well. So yeah, the point of ritual death is a literal death. It's an influential character who dies and it sort of knocks the stuffing out of everyone and makes them really reassess their lives and think, maybe I should stop wasting time and I should think about settling down.
Yeah.
Which leads Hugh Grant to almost make a terrible mistake, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the one before, and, you know, the 60% where, you know, it's they might have sex. It, as you said, it doesn't necessarily have to be sex. It might just be they might kiss.
Yeah.
Or there might be a moment where there seems to be this step forward in their relationship. But usually it's based on something a bit more carnal.
Yes, I mean, if we're looking
held back in terms of the emotions or the understanding or, you know, things like that.
Yes, if we're looking at Pride and Prejudice, it would be the evening when Elizabeth and her aunt and uncle go to Pemberley.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth kind of bonds with Miss Darcy and helps cover up a blunder over Mr. Wickham, etc.,
yeah.
Which Caroline Bingley's rather stupidly thrown into conversation. And they just, and it's literally characterised in the book with a single line where they just meet gazes.
Yeah.
Which I think they do in the adaptation as well.
Oh, they really do, and it's such a great shot.
So, yeah, it is that genuine, the fact that they haven't physically touched at all, but it is that implied carnal moment, as Madeline said. And again, if you went through, I think if you went through the TV series in, you know, sort of frame by frame and added the minutes up, you would find that came almost bang on the 60% mark.
Yeah.
After that, you get the point of ritual death, as I said, and then you usually get the look in the mirror moment, which is literally a case of the main character suddenly goes, oh my God, I've just realised something about myself. This is a game changer.
Yeah. For instance, with Elizabeth Bennet, it's, I love him and I'm now never going to be able to be with him.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Shit. And then there's lots of tiny little milestone steps into the resolution that go into it in order to make it a satisfying resolution. Basically, if you're interested in all of this plotting in detail, there is a great book called A Natural History of the Romance Novel by Pamela Regis. You should totally read that. It's incredibly in-depth and intricate. And I read it intending never to write a romance novel, but it taught me so much about structure. And you can actually date my love of structure back to the time I read that book.
Yeah, here's a challenge for anyone is to write, you know, a story about two enemies, which is written as, you know, as a romance. Where it's actually, you know, the meet cute and stuff like that is just the first time they meet their nemesis. Which is, I guess, kind of what happens between Charles Xavier and Magneto.
Yeah, I mean, my theory is the ones where people go, oh, I love these guys together, even if they are enemies or frenemies or whatever, is the fact that the ones that we really bond with are the ones that hit that those romance milestones, even if it's not a romance.
Yeah, absolutely.
I am 90% certain that is true of almost all of them.
Yeah.
Okay. So, other things you can learn. It's not just about structure. Pacing, tension, and timing. These things have to be spot on in successful romance novels, and particularly in romantic comedies.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're in Flopsville again.
Yeah. And this is particularly the case for romances which are romantic comedy. Romantic comedies are very popular. I'm not going to go say they're common, but it's a very popular sort of genre. And actually, I cannot think of any two genres coming together which are harder to do in terms of having to absolutely get everything right. Because comedy is also one of those ones where you every point needs to be timed perfectly, because otherwise the humour doesn't work. It's all about the timing. So when you've got comedy and romance, a lot of planning and thought has gone into that.
Definitely. And it is romance requires its own timing and its own very stringent structure, as we've said, which requires timing.
Yeah.
You also have to be a master of creating tension, if not conflict, in order to sustain interest in all of that. And then, you know, there's the saying that the difference between comedy and tragedy is timing.
Yeah.
So you want it, a romantic comedy, to be funny because you've intended it to be funny, not because you completely missed the mark. So you could learn a lot from watching good romantic comedies. A favourite of mine, which gets watched once every couple of years, is While You Were Sleeping.
Aww.
Which is very funny, but I mean, again, it's it hits all those beats that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And she's the main character is very lonely, ultimately. Lucy is very, very sweet. She's a really likeable person, a really nice person. She's lost her only family, her father, a couple of years before, and she doesn't have anybody else. And she sort of falls, like, aesthetically in love with this guy who regularly goes past her booth at the railway station, until she's working one Christmas morning because she has nobody else, and he turns up again, and she finally has a chance to talk to him, and she completely muffs it.
No.
She's kind of like, he's like, he says hi and Merry Christmas to her, and he's gone before she can say everything. And you can see her there going, hi, Merry Christmas, I love you. Kind of really frustrated. Next thing she knows, he's getting mugged, he gets thrown on the tracks and knocked out, and she ends up saving his life.
Yeah.
He ends up in a coma. And then his family's there, and the next thing she knows, the nurse has told them by accident that she's his fiancé, because she's been talking to herself saying, oh, I was going to marry him, kind of thing.
Yeah.
As you do. And the nurse tells his family this, and they're kind of like, no, she is family, she's the fiancé, and she can't get out of it, and then she doesn't want to get out of it because she's not alone anymore. And then she really complicates it by falling in love with his brother.
Oh, no.
Timing-wise, I mean, it's kind of, it should be cheesy, and it's not cheesy. And the reason it's not cheesy is because it is absolutely pitch perfect in terms of structure and timing and comedy.
I've not actually watched it. I've just...
You really, really should do it. Okay, we're buddy watching that at some point, because you have to see what I mean.
Agreed.
But it is... But it does genuinely work. I would consider Love Actually to be a romantic comedy, even though technically you're not following the path of two people, you're following the path of a selection of people.
Yeah.
And what it's looking at is the different types of love that interconnect various different people.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even so, it still manages to hit those beats. That's why it's such an accomplished film. Is it still managing to follow a broad romance structure, even though it's following about six different sets of people.
Yeah. And one of my personal favourites is obviously Bridget Jones.
Yeah. The films are quite funny. I prefer the books, but again, the books are absolutely pitch perfect in terms of timing and structure.
Yeah.
I mean, Bridget Jones's Diary is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice.
It is, so that, you know, and, she is pulling off that. But, you know, she's really bringing in the comedic elements as well.
She really is. The next one, Bridget Jones at the Edge of Reason, is a retelling of Persuasion. And then she's done the same, something very similar with Mad About the Boy.
Yeah.
As well. So, yeah, they are really, really genuinely good books. And I don't think I've ever read anything that's made me laugh out loud so much. As in, genuinely have been biting onto a cushion with tears streaming down my face, reading them at midnight kind of thing, trying not to wake the rest of the house.
Aww.
So, very, very funny. Even though I don't necessarily share a lot in common with the main character or her experiences, the way it's done is just so funny. Other things, and this will be a shorter point hopefully, is it teaches you about creating character attachment.
Yeah. One of the main things you want in a romance is that you want people to be able to connect with the characters.
Yes, and I have read romance writers who have done the thing where they've created a main character who is literally just a mask, yeah. And that works for some people. Some people literally just want something where they're in the story and they don't have to contend with the main character's actual character too much.
Yeah.
I prefer them to actually have a character.
Yeah.
Obviously, because it's escapism for me in that respect. And I'm not fond of the, okay, well, the love interest is clearly going to be a super possessive alpha male because that is boring as fish kind of thing.
But... yeah. No, I agree. I just don't find it that romantic.
It's not. It's kind of like, just back off and let me get on with my own thing, all right?
It's just a little bit creepy, to be honest.
But, you know, this is a staple of very paranormal romance, and the people who read it in droves, and that's clearly what most of them want, unfortunately for me, but that's what they want. So,
yeah, fair enough. And as I said, it's fantasy, and that's fine. Nobody's actually getting hurt, except for people who romanticise it and then start to emulate it in life, and then maybe some people are getting hurt. But the point is that it's within book form. Yes, it's fine, and it is popular. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything bad about you, but yeah, I agree. I just, whenever I see it, it's just like, big alpha male, and I'm like, no thank you.
It's like, no. This is why all my romance stuff, my subplots and things, are now going to be about, you know, the slightly unlikely romance. I think the most likely romantic hero I've had is Kieran, and the rest of them have been kind of like, not the stuff that dreams are made of. And it's going to keep being the nice guy.
Yeah, but you put Kieran through the ringer, and he was still... Kieran is also sweet. And
yeah.
He is a little bit unlikely in some ways as well.
So. This is true. I don't think I could ever just write an alpha male. I'd be so bored.
Yeah.
Same thing goes for men writing female characters, by the way. Describing how someone is dressed or what her breasts look like is not the same as giving someone characterization.
What are you talking about? Characterization is entirely in the breasts.
It is that classic, you know, she breasted boobily down the stairs and titted down the hall, isn't it? It's like, we're genuinely not that conscious of them, guys. Seriously, think about things other than, and when I say think about things other than that, I don't mean think about hair colour or, you know, how tight her shorts were or anything like that.
Whenever I come across that, I just think, I just want him to sort of sit down and just write about his... The only time it would be acceptable is if he was writing about his male characters in the same way, just being incredibly conscious of their genitalia constantly. just like... I don't even want to say it,
my testicles looked perky and well separated that morning. I felt confident. I chose my tightest slacks. You could practically read my credit card through the back pocket. I could have a lot of fun with that, but
really good.
So yeah, okay. While some people prefer sparser characters, please actually give your characters characterization. I know I bang this drum a lot, but I can't put it down. I've got to keep saying it.
3 a.m. It's like, Jules is outside your door banging pots and pans.
It's like, this is like, you wouldn't say she had a nicely separated pair of kidneys, would you? You wouldn't say that's characterization. So it should, the same applies for any other body part.
What does nicely separated pair of kidneys even mean?
I guess that they're not like all squished up together, or
well, I mean, it would be weird. That's a good thing. I don't think kidneys should be smushed up together.
Her liver was a perfectly acceptable shade of dark pink that morning. She felt confident.
How does she know?
I know. Okay, clearly I'm going to start a new genre where I write spoofs of these bad romantic tropes.
Please do.
He was into her for her brains, literally. Oh, that's zombie fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to go ahead and say.
Okay, so basically everything we've said is that romance can teach you about delivering what your target audience wants, even if you don't like romance. So you can learn a lot about structure. In fact, you can probably learn more about structure, reliable structure, from reading a few romance novels than you can from other things. And it doesn't need to be hard work. You can pick the ones that suit you. Okay, right, so let's end with we've got our favourite romances, romantic subplots, but I think let's go at it from the angle of what makes us ship a pair of characters.
Yes. Honestly, this sounds so silly, but chemistry does really come into it. And I do think in particular, when you see it on camera, but also when you sort of see it in books, there needs to be this sense of something has been sparked between them. And usually for me, it's that they have met on some level, intellectually or emotionally. They're on the same wavelength, they're hitting the same points, and usually humour is the way that if two people sort of have maybe a similar kind of sense of humour or something like that, I tend to go, I like it.
Yeah. Also a juxtaposition, yeah. A good juxtaposition, so it's not just opposites attract, it's a case of,
yeah,
okay, well, this person's clearly got a bit of a lack in this area,
yeah,
but they make up for it in this area where that person has a lack, and they kind of like, they complement each other.
Yeah, absolutely. It's when, it really should almost feel like two pieces of a puzzle, which I also don't like saying, because that suggests that people are just extensions, you know, just meant to, yeah, fit only with one another. But it should feel like there is something coming together, that they actually fit well, rather than just, and here we have it, and you just sort of put them on top of each other like coasters.
Okay, you didn't intend the double entendre there, did you? You'll do.
Yeah, that's how it works. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know, it's quite difficult to get me to ship people. Because even when someone manages to get chemistry in there and shows that they're complementary, and even if they're characters I care about, I'm not necessarily that invested in the love story. However, when I do ship, I ship really hard, kind of thing. It just sort of comes out of nowhere. You've made me believe it.
Yeah.
If you then take that away from me, we are not on good terms.
Yeah, I agree. And I also tend to, I really like the slow burn as well. Yeah. Because that tends to really intensify feelings when it's just that they're slowly coming together and you're like, come on, come on!
I was going to say, that's just as well. Mind you, you were kind of like, by the time you got to I Rule the Night, you were kind of like, okay, Em just needs to drag him off to bed. She really does now. It's got to happen. What, they're not talking to each other?
I was still enjoying it, but that's the point of the slow burn, is you're just there like, just come on, get over it, and it's just that, it's that anticipation. So yeah, I was absolutely with M. But also, I do tend to get this thing where I see two people together, within fiction, I should say, not within real life, and you kind of get this good feeling where of the potential of what they could be together, the potential of what would happen if they came together, and how one might sort of, not improve is the wrong word, but how one might affect the other.
Yeah.
And what they could become. And I think that that tends to be something that I really, really will really get me going in terms of, okay, actually, I really like this pairing because I like the way that they look together. You know, sometimes I look at two characters, I'm like, actually, really together, you sort of, it suggests like you might just bring out the worst in each other, or that you're not actually going to be contributing anything to each other. And so, yeah, when I start to ship, I ship very hard. I'm not going to say who, but there's a couple of characters in Jules's books.
Forthcoming series.
Which, I've not even read the books yet. I haven't had a chance, but Jules has been sending me snippets, and I have started shipping these characters so hard.
It's like, and it, obviously I can't say very much because I don't want to spoilify Madeline or anything either, but she comes back with, no, it's like, no, I really think, it's just been really funny over the last few months of it started with, I ship these two. I'm like, really? Based on that? Because she's with so-and-so, etc., etc. You're like, oh, I guess not. Maybe it's just the way they're interacting. And then there was a bit from another book. You're like, no, I really, really think they need to have a conversation. And it's just gone on. I'm now on book four. And I'm still getting that. I'm still really, really shipping them.
Well, it's because, I don't know, because I'm hoping that they're end game and that you're starting to weave that in there now, and that's what I'm picking up on. Because every now and again I do come up with that, oh, I ship those two, and then someone's just like, yeah, they're, you know, non-compatible for XYZ, and then I go, oh no. Which is why when you were like, really? And I was like, oh, maybe I have completely misread this situation. But then you kept sending me stuff and I was like, I like it. I'm not gonna lie, I like this. They've got a good wavelength together. They're good for each other. I can live in hope. Let a girl live in hope, Jules.
Well, you can absolutely live in hope. I will tell you nothing. I just think you're going to be doing a lot of screaming at me over the next year.
I am ready for a long, long, long burn. And fan fiction to fix it if you don't give me what I want.
Yeah, I don't give you the end game that you're after. You're just going to rewrite it.
No, I mean, to be honest, I don't actually mind if a pairing that I have, it doesn't turn out to be end game, as long as it feels kind of like justified, and that there's a good sense of the romance. Something I can't stand is sometimes people just do this kind of 180 to sort of surprise you, and I'm just there like, this doesn't feel right at all. It feels strange.
SJ Mass, for example.
I wasn't going to bring her up. But
she felt like the elephant in the room at that point, so I thought I'd say something. And
yeah,
it's the whole Elaine and
Lucien. If she if she pairs him with Azrael, that would be very interesting, and I might be down for it.
I would not have seen that coming. I will honestly say I would not have seen that coming. Yeah, that's unfair, because there was a horrible, toxic, hundreds of years old situation there, which has completely destroyed one of the other characters.
Yeah.
In terms of credibility. And, yeah. So to now go, oh yeah, but I don't think I can use this character for whatever reason. And a lot of it will be down to, oh, but there is the taint of Tamlin about him, which is really, really unfair. Anyway.
The taint of Tamlin. That's a whole other conversation.
Honestly, the next book will decide one way or another whether I'm going to continue reading her books.
Yeah.
It's out in February. And it's a case of, I have to, because I need to know what happens to Nesta, but I think I'm going to be really angry most of the time.
I'm reading this, but I don't like it.
I'm not super happy at who Nesta's mate is supposed to be anyway.
You're not a fan of Cassian.
No, I thought he was fine until he started messing with my girl, you know? He's obviously not good enough. Yeah, it was the bit in... It was the... was it... Did we just get a snippet of the new book at the end of A Court of Frost and Starlight or something?
I can't
remember now. But anyway, it was the... It was the implied misogyny really sort of like... bugged me. Anyway, let's not open that can of worms. Pushing the lid firmly back on that can.
Back in, worms! Back in!
Back in. Wiggle no more.
It just sounds like it's really bad Shakespeare. Wiggle no more, ye worms!
Oh no, we can't do that. That's another can of worms we can't open.
Yes, what were we saying?
That brings us to the end of this episode on what you can learn about writing from romance as a genre.
Yeah.
So if you have any comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. If you can, you know, if you've suddenly had a light bulb moment and gone, oh yeah, there's this, this and this, and we haven't touched on it, then drop us a line. We'd love to know.
Yeah, and do let us know who your favourite romance partners are, or your favourite romance in general, or a romance that really didn't work for you. Remember, you can get in touch with us on Twitter, on Tumblr, and on Facebook, or individually. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, for the first time in about 6 months, I went out to the cinema on Friday. Clearly not a lot of people are going to the cinema at the moment, because I had the three of us who went together had the entire cinema to ourselves.
Nice.
It was very strange. It was kind of like being a movie star or something, you know, when they close everything off for you. And the poor staff looked so relieved to see somebody turn up. Anyway, we went to see Tenet, which has been getting a fair bit of buzz, I think. And it's done by Christopher Nolan, who obviously did some of the Batman films and did Inception, which, you know, if you've seen Inception, you'll know it's a slightly angst-inspiring, existential, brain-twisty type film. This is also a brain-twisty type film.
Yay.
I don't want to give too much of the plot away. But basically, a CIA agent, bad situation, ends up being considered legally dead and is offered the chance to do another job, and he discovers this technology which seems to effectively make time run backwards, or you know, with certain objects, and it turns into this big race against time in order to stop this massive arms deal. And there's lots of mystery and there's lots of threads and things woven in. Don't think about the physics too hard. They've played a bit pick and mix with it, and some of it genuinely doesn't work. But that was me being a bit pan out. I could not switch off that part of my brain, unfortunately, because I've been reading about a lot of this stuff recently. But it is incredibly immersive and entertaining. The characterization is good, which, you know, you'd expect, because he does do great characterization in his films. Black male lead, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of diversity. And in terms of diversity, where it's real characters, not just a case of it's a tick box thing. It's the kind of diversity where it's you wouldn't notice it if you weren't thinking, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
This is the sort of film that they would normally people entirely with men and white actors.
Yeah, fantastic.
And it's not like that at all. It is really, really good. I do recommend it. Obviously, go when you're fairly awake. This is not a film to go and fall asleep to. You do actually have to pay attention. It's a lot of fun, and it's sort of part spy movie, part almost supernatural thriller, part sci-fi type thing.
Fantastic. On that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.